A drone takes off on a runway and flies over villages at the foot of barren mountains.
High above the war zone, the all-seeing eye of the West searches out the enemy. But what do we really know about the enemy? The terrorists claim they are fighting for Islam. The vast majority of Muslims, and Western leaders too, insist that they have nothing to do with Islam.
Bombs rip through devastated cities.
But who is right? There is only one way to discover the origins of the extreme violence of ISIS. By taking a journey into the past.
The drone continues its flight over the sprawling landscape. ISIS, the origins of violence. The London Eye slowly rotating, then a view over the River Thames under a cloudy sky. London. People walking about in busy streets.
My name is Tom Holland. In 2012, I made a film about the origins of Islam. But a lot has happened since then. It's as if something buried deep in the past has caught up with us. Things have been done in the name of Islam that I would never have imagined happening.
King's College London.
I promised myself I'd never go back there again. But here I am, going back.
This is our Khilafah in all its glory. We are men honored with Islam who climbed its peaks to perform jihad, answering the call to unite under one flag. This is the source of our glory, our obedience to our Lord. So bring it on, all of you. Your numbers only increase us in faith, and we're counting your banners, which our prophet said would reach 80 in number. And then the flames of war will finally burn you on the hills of death. Bring it on. Bring it on.
So we've grown very accustomed to the ultra-violence of Islamic State, and that's the thing that really captures the headlines, it captures our imagination. So it develops this strategy of extreme and brutal and ultra-violence in order to try and intimidate its opponents into saying, well, we may not get to you today or tomorrow, but if we do, we will be so barbaric and sadistic and horrific that we just want you to understand the cost of participation against us is not just here, but right up here. We're going to continually raise the cost of participation.
ISIS. Even here, it fills you with a kind of horror.
They use this principle called mumathala. What happens is they don't just burn him alive in the cage, but at the end of the cage, a truck comes and drops rubble on top of the cage. And that rubble and rock is from a site that they said he had bombed.
These atrocities are like video games. They've got a kind of script. The scripts have to start somewhere and lead somewhere.
My own feeling is that this is a problem and a crisis that will be around probably for the rest of our lifetime.
From Tom stepping out of a railway station to the Eiffel Tower in a hazy sky.
You come to Paris because ISIS come to Paris. Because ISIS have a thing about Paris. They've attacked concert halls and football stadiums. They killed the cartoonists of Charlie Hebdo. They shot dead a policeman here on the Champs-Élysées. But what's all this got to do with Islam? In fact, what's it got to do with Paris?
Tom's in a modest hotel room.
ISIS call Paris the capital of prostitution and vice. They call France the home of the Crusades. It just seems crazy. All those killings.
He gazes out of a rain-covered window.
It's like fiction. Something out of the Da Vinci Code. With every new atrocity, they're sending out a message. But what is the message? And who's it being sent to? You can't help thinking that somehow the answers are here, in Paris.
The streets of Paris have always been witness to violent crimes. Up here, for instance, there was a particularly brutal killing. A man was seized, a knife was put to his throat, and his neck was severed off. And you could almost say that Paris begins with this beheading.
Tom reaches the top of some steps.
But that was long ago, in the 3rd century, when Saint-Denis, the first bishop of Paris, lost his head here in Montmartre. But in those days, it was the victims who were the martyrs. Today, it's the killers who go to paradise. And people who live here are nervous. The Bastille. I got a message to meet someone here, a refugee just escaped from ISIS. He doesn't want us to reveal his name.
Sometimes I don't want to remember these things, but I think I have to tell it. When I went there, I saw a crossed man.
On the cross?
Yeah.
And what had he done, do you know?
They said he is a spy.
Right. Was he alive or dead?
And the dogs,
was he dead or alive? I mean,
dead? The dogs were eating his flesh. Yeah, it was horrible.
Do you feel safe now you are in France? You know, here we are being filmed,
yeah,
but you have your back to the camera. You don't want to be seen on camera. Why is that?
They will kill my family because of me.
Will it be dangerous for me?
To the, you mean to the borders of the Islamic State? Yeah, it will be dangerous.
He tells me that even though he escaped from ISIS in Iraq, he still doesn't feel safe in Paris. And after what happened round the corner from the Bastille, maybe he's right.
It's nighttime, and Tom's walking with a man. It was 9:40 p.m. on the 13th of November. I was working at home, up there. Suddenly, I heard fireworks going off, like a firework display. People were shouting and falling in the street. The terrorists were shooting them in the back.
Les uns après les autres, parce que la porte était là, les terroristes étaient dans la salle, et ils leur tiraient dans le dos.
Shaky footage of people spilling out of a building's back exit.
Daniel Senny's flat overlooked the street behind the Bataclan. He filmed the ISIS attack from his balcony, and he still hasn't recovered from being shot in the arm.
People escaping are having to step over the bodies outside the doorway. Dead bodies were everywhere. I was asking, what's happening? But they just ran past me.
Mais en s'enfuyant ici, ils ne regardaient pas en haut.
Qu'est-ce qui se passe? Qu'est-ce qui se passe?
A pregnant woman was hanging down from the window. More people flee in a panic, running fast down the back street, while the pregnant woman hangs from the window ledge 15 feet above the ground. A father was calling his son, Oscar, Oscar. Pleading for help, people are trying to drag limp bodies away from the scene. Then the police arrived, but only the normal police. Amateur footage shows injured people slumped on the ground as a policeman peeking at the back street from behind a corner shouts, "Get the helmets and shields, for fuck's sake!" footage of someone tending to another victim on a cafe's curbside terrace.
90 people were killed at the Bataclan. Another 40 were shot in cafes and bars across Paris.
Oh, merde. Oh, merde.
These were not simple murders. These were murders in the service of an idea.
Dead bodies lying amongst pools of blood and broken glass.
The victims were merely the means of conveying the message. Young people dead, all the killers dead, all killed in the name of God. Everything in the name of God. But to do something like this, you've got to have a very good idea of what God wants.
A view of railway tracks from a train's window.
The truth is, we all know that people have killed in the name of God, Christians no less than Muslims. But ISIS are raising a lot of ghosts from the past. We've just gone through Vienna. Muslim armies came this far twice. We've passed a town where they massacred everyone. And the further east across Europe you go, the more people remember things like this.
In his cabin, Tom's watching a video on his laptop. A man in an orange jumpsuit's kneeling on the ground, hands tied behind his back, and a heavily armed, masked man is looming behind him. A second armed man approaches and hands a tangled length of explosive wire to the first, who proceeds to wrap it around the captive's neck. Tom watches with a frown as the video now shows the captive kneeling alone, filmed from a distance. Tom's head jerks back a little as he takes in the gruesome sight. A half moon hangs in the night sky.
It's nightmarish. And it's supposed to be. ISIS have a user's manual. It's called The Management of Savagery. We need to massacre others, it says. Hostages must be eliminated in a terrifying manner. The circumstances we are now in resemble those faced by the first Muslims.
ISIS, the origins of violence. Ships on calm waters. Istanbul.
Istanbul, a city that has always been in the crosshairs of the titanic rivalry between Christendom and Islam. But it is also a city that shaped the very beginnings of Islam.
Tom's walking by the Bosphorus.
In the early 8th century, it was a Christian capital, Constantinople, and an Arab war fleet was laying siege to its walls.
Constantinople, the capital of the Christian Roman Empire, the greatest city in the world, the great object of Muslim desire. The Arabs believed that they had been promised the world by God, and so they wanted to reach out and take it, probably more than anywhere else in the world. And they did that twice, and twice they failed to do it. They were so tantalizingly close, but they couldn't quite get hold of it. And so in the face of that failure, they went back to first principles. They asked themselves, what should we be doing here? And they decided that what God wanted was struggle, jihad.
Archive footage of ancient fortifications.
So this is where the notion of jihad really begins, before the walls of Constantinople. In the Quran, jihad meant the effort required to be a good Muslim, but defeat here gave it a much sharper meaning. Sacred violence. Stories began to be told of Muhammad, that he'd believed those who died fighting for Islam would receive the greatest rewards in heaven. The sword scrapes away sin. As a result, those who had died here were cast as martyrs.
In here we've got the tomb of supposedly an Arab soldier in the first Arab campaign that was sent against Constantinople, and he is supposed to have died here, so he ranks as a martyr. He died for his faith, and the site of his tomb was discovered supposedly after the Muslims had conquered Constantinople in 1453, so many centuries afterwards. And you might think this was quite a convenient, not to say improbable, discovery.
Nevertheless, this tomb in here commemorates one of Islam's earliest jihadis.
Hagia Sophia in the distance.
With the Ottoman conquest of Constantinople, the city became the capital of a great Islamic civilization. Its sultans ruled as caliphs, successors of Muhammad himself, and claimed the allegiance of Muslims across the world. But then, a century ago, came the fall. The Royal Navy in the Bosphorus marked the end of the First World War. Allied troops occupied Istanbul. A new Turkish strongman arrived, Atatürk, a moderniser with little time for Islam. In 1924, his assault on Islamic tradition reached a seismic climax.
Tom's on a boat cruising past a grand palace on the water's edge.
This is the Dolmabahçe Palace. It was built in the mid-19th century. Now, the reason that it is a museum these days is because the dynasty for which it was built, the Ottoman caliphs, no longer exists. And the reason for that is that on the 3rd of March 1924, the caliphate itself was abolished. So a line of caliphs that stretched all the way back to the lifetime of those who'd known Muhammad himself was terminated. And that evening, the prefect of police came to the palace and told the caliph, Abdülmecid II, that it was all over, that he had to leave, and that he had to pack his bags and go that very night.
The last caliph left Istanbul at 5:30 in the morning.
Tom's in a taxi.
His journey into exile took him across the Galata Bridge. He headed north through the aqueduct of Valens. Along the ancient walls and out through the Edina Gate, where almost 500 years before, the Sultan who had conquered Constantinople first entered the city.
Railway tracks at a seemingly deserted train station.
The Caliph and his family were dumped here, a provincial railway station 30 miles outside Istanbul, by authorities who wanted as few people as possible to know what was happening. He waited at the station house for 13 hours. The train, when it arrived, was the Orient Express. Ironically enough, then as now, one of the most flamboyant symbols of Western wealth and reach. An extra carriage had been added for his luggage and his wives. He left with a Swiss visa and 2,000 British pounds. He never came back. In the West, no one remembers this moment.
Tom watches a train pulling away from the station.
But as Osama bin Laden did, when he destroyed the World Trade Center, it was the end of the caliphate that was uppermost in his mind. Our nation, he declared, has been tasting this humiliation and contempt for more than 80 years.
He turns away and walks off. Northern Iraq.
The caliphate is the kind of ideal that never completely disappears. For years it was locked up in history's left luggage. But then someone picked up the key.
Allah commands us to fight his enemies and to wage jihad in his name.
In 2014, ISIS declared a new caliphate. Their leader, al-Baghdadi, became the new caliph.
Tom's driving through an arid landscape. Allah's religion will never be established unless the law of Allah is observed and Islamic punishments are implemented. Allah has created us to worship Him alone and establish His religion. Tom's at a monastery built on a mountainside.
This is the monastery of Mar Matai, St. Matthew. Founded in the 4th century, it's the oldest monastery in Iraq.
A tiled internal courtyard.
Once there were thousands of monks here. Now, only a handful. And when I came here a few months ago, it was not hard to find the reason why.
If you'd looked out here 1,200 years ago, you would have been looking at the beating heart of Christendom, because at a time when the Christians of Europe were embattled and impoverished, the Christians of the lands out there were enjoying a golden age. Those days have long gone. In this huge monastery, there are now only two monks. And if those two monks ventured down there beyond that ridge, you see there are two black patches over there, like kind of patches of mold. Those are villages. And if the monks went into those villages, they would be killed on the spot. Just beyond the horizon lies the city of Mosul, where for the first time in 1,500 years, mass is no longer heard. And the reason for that is that over there, those lands that were once the Christian heartlands are now the Islamic State. Out there are the shock troops of ISIS.
From views over the sprawling desert to a spinning ceiling fan.
A holy place.
I should also show you the secret altar in the monastery. Maybe if you want, you can see it now.
I would like that.
Yes.
Thank you. Father Yusuf is one of the very few monks left in this monastery. For 1,400 years, Christians here have been preparing for the worst. But there's no way to prepare against ISIS.
And we have another more secretly from here.
Oh, yes.
Yes, this one.
An altar hidden in a rock cavity.
You can see it's so small. It's not take more than four people. The priest and the monks here, they used to use this altar when they were attacked. It's isolated, so they can, no one can hear them, and no one know that they are here. Yes.
It must make you feel
very close to the founder of the church.
Yes,
to be here and facing what you face.
Yusuf nods with a smile. A view of the monastery blending in with its barren surroundings.
Marmatai has a long history, but has it got a future?
I don't see any future for the Christian here.
So why are you here?
It's my duty, firstly. My faith, what I'm learned from my religion, from the word of the Bible, the Jesus Christ, that's made me not afraid from any things. Because they can do nothing more than to kill me.
1400 years ago, monks like Father Yusuf provided Muhammad himself with a model of holiness. Islam, though, would give monasticism a novel spin. Our monasticism, the Prophet is reported as saying, is jihad in the cause of God. Our monasticism is the crying of Allahu Akbar on hilltops.
Tom's walking down a deserted street in a town ravaged by warfare. Almost all of the buildings have been turned to rubble.
This is Sinjar, 80 miles west of the monastery. ISIS came here in August 2014. By the time they left 5 months later, 5,000 men had been massacred, women and children carried off.
The sun beats down over Tom, who's wearing a bulletproof vest bearing the word press.
Sponge pants, Bob.
A child's item trapped in the broken concrete and twisted metal of a collapsed building.
It's the quality of nightmare. Walking through an absolutely shattered city and you see cartoon character. And then on the other side you've got what looks like a kind of Roman city, you know. Except that this destruction was made, you know, it wasn't made by legions, it was made by suicide bombers.
A view of the overwhelming devastation, with a distant cloud of thick black smoke rising over the remaining rooftops. Tom continues exploring what's left of the town.
When they came into Sinjar, they left heads everywhere on spikes, hanging in public places like the cruelest of Mesopotamian kings, and like a Roman legion, they took away the women and the girls into slavery. So what I think is, they're like ghosts risen up from the past of vanished empires. And they're kind of like ghouls picking their way over this rubble. Oh, I'm gonna be sick.
He opens up the sides of his bulletproof vest and leans forward, hands on his knees. Doubled over, he stares at the dusty ground, waiting for his nausea to pass. The street ahead of him is littered with rubble spilling from the buildings flanking it. He straps his vest back on and heads up the street. He picks his way through the ruins. He reaches the end of a path which has been cleared through the otherwise impassable devastation.
What I'm thinking is, that when you go to a Roman city and you go up a street like Pompeii or something, you can be reasonably sure that you're not going to get blown up. But this looks like it hasn't been cleared. And there's been a lot of fighting here. And part of me is wondering what might go off at any minute. And it strikes me that, that's kind of true to history, actually, because there are things in the past that are like unexploded bombs that just lie in wait in the rubble, and then something happens to trigger them. And there are clearly verses in the Quran and stories that are told about Muhammad that are very like mines waiting to go off, improvised explosive devices, and they can lie there for, you know, maybe for centuries. And then something happens to trigger them, and you get this.
Endless rubble lays ahead, buildings completely destroyed, save for a few walls still upright.
Scary. Really scary.
He sits down on a lump of concrete on the edge of the path. In the distance, a cross juts out, standing askew over the ruins. Tom removes his glasses and rubs his eye wearily.
The question is, if these were unexploded bombs, then what were they doing here? And what triggered them to go off?
Tom's back at the Department of War Studies, King's College London.
So it is possible for Muslims in Islamic State to genuinely feel that God wants them to commit the violence that they are committing?
Yes. The members of Islamic State who conduct these acts regard themselves as doing God's work. They regard themselves as being just, that they are implementing the laws of God. And they would say, you know, it's not for us to decide, it's not for us to bring our own inclinations or whims to this matter.
What about the things for which it's particularly notorious, say, the beheadings, the crucifixions?
Beheadings, crucifixions, these are all things that are discussed within the context of the Islamic punishment system. So again, Islamic State would say that they are implementing these punishments as they've understood them from the texts.
Do you think that they genuinely think that they will defeat the West, that Islam will conquer the world?
They absolutely believe Islam will conquer the world.
And how ancient do you think that assumption is? How far back does this idea that conquering the world for Islam is for the good of the world?
I think it has always been present within a strain of Islamic thought.
Sinjar, Iraq. Footage of armed men singing while marching down a street.
ISIS fighters in Sinjar. Most Muslims regard them with horror. But are they really a dark and ancient strain of Islamic thought? The law of jihad is coming, they sing. Follow their trail, and we can see what their version of jihad meant for the people of Sinjar.
Tom's inside the ruins of a mosque.
This is a Shia mosque. ISIS are Sunni. They despise the Shia.
He leafs through a prayer book found in the rubble.
According to ISIS, if you're Muslim and you don't believe what ISIS believes, then you're not really Muslim at all. You're an apostate. And based on what Muhammad said, the penalty for apostasy is death. But ISIS treat different religions in different ways. Christians and Jews, the so-called people of the book, are offered a way out. You pay a tax, the jizya, the Quran says, then they'll be tolerated, albeit as second-class citizens. Muslim rulers enforced the jizya for over 1,000 years. It was only finally abolished in the 19th century. But now, obedient to the letter of the Quran, ISIS have brought it back. But it's outside in the streets that you can most clearly see how the Quran's attitude to other religions has left its mark on ISIS. Every house has been painted with a sign. This house is Sunni. This one, Shia. And this one, Yazidi. Sinjar had a large population of Yazidis, a religious minority who, unlike the Christians, are not a people of the book. And it is what happened to the Yazidis that revealed the very cruelest face of ISIS.
Masses of people marching through a punishing desert, some carrying small children, others with a few possessions, many of them with nothing at all. There are Yazidis who now live on Sinjar Mountain. There's a campaign of genocide being waged on the Yazidis. 30,000 families are besieged on Sinjar Mountain without water and food. They are dying. 500 Yazidi men have already been slaughtered. Mr. Speaker, we are being slaughtered under the banner of "There is no God but Allah." Our women are being taken as slaves and sold in the slave market. I speak here in the name of humanity. Save us! Save us! We are being slaughtered. We are being exterminated. An entire religion is being exterminated from the face of the earth. Brothers, I appeal to you in the name of humanity to save us. Mr. Speaker, I want... Someone thanks the woman as she breaks down in tears, and the people around her keep her steady. Everyone in the room was standing to hear her desperate plea. Tom's with a man by an abandoned construction site in the desert. They were all Yazidis. Women were separated from their children. The bastards then took the young and beautiful women to the edge of the village and killed all the rest. The fenced-off foundations of a building.
This is where the old women from the village of Kocho met their fate. Old women don't sell in the slave markets. And so 78 of them were brought here and killed.
This is a shawl. The older women wear them. The shawl seems particularly burnt. This is a woman's shoe, her hair and her bones. The man picks up what looks like a piece of skull.
Mohammed said, avoid injustice. The vast majority of Muslims would never hesitate to condemn this as a monstrous crime. So how could ISIS possibly believe that this was justified?
A view over the city of Amman, Jordan.
When ISIS explained their actions, they appealed to one thing, not conscience, not human rights. They appealed to the law of God, Sharia. But Islamic law fills whole books, and there are many interpretations. So how do ISIS interpret it? Jordan was the birthplace of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the jihadi credited with founding ISIS. His interpretation of Islamic law was so bloody that even Al-Qaeda disowned him. Abu Sayyaf was also a jihadi, and with al-Zarqawi in jail, freed under an amnesty, he's now the leader of Jordan's Salafists, hardliners who take their interpretation from the example of the earliest Muslims.
How central is Sharia to Islam?
You cannot be a Muslim if you don't follow the Prophet's laws. Sharia is compulsory. All Muslims must follow Sharia. God makes the rules, and he rules by Sharia.
In the West, our laws are human. We do not derive our laws from a god. Does that make them inferior?
Tom stares impassively as Abu Sayyaf says, laws made by God are better than laws made by man. The laws of man are not universal. They change according to time and place, but the laws of God will last until the end of time.
So what is it in Sharia that suggests to ISIS that the Yazidis deserve death?
Lalish, Iraq. A village nestled amongst hills dotted with small trees. When the world was created, life began here. Lalish is the most important place for us. This ground is sacred to the Yazidis. It will always be that way. Tom wanders through the village.
What is it about the Yazidis that has always made them such objects of hatred? Under the Ottomans, there was a fatwa giving Muslim rulers a complete right to kill their men and capture their children and women.
Men are sweeping dust on the ground.
Lalish, the holiest Yazidi shrine, is full of clues. This is a place of traditions older by far than Islam. The lighting of fires derives from the Zoroastrians of ancient Persia. Like the Jews, the Yazidis have their stories of Noah. This room is holy to a saint whose name echoes that of the sun in Babylon. Threads of different cults and religions have been woven seamlessly together here. This, for instance, is where Yazidis say Adam was created. Adam, who is a Muslim prophet. To Muslims, it can hardly help but seem simultaneously pagan and blasphemous. Step by step, the case against the Yazidis mounts up.
Children and women kiss the ground and walls at the entrance of a temple before entering.
But it's in here that we get clues to what, for most Muslims, is the ultimate blasphemy.
Tom steps inside. A shaft of light from a small, high window pierces through the darkness of the temple, where coloured cloths are hanging on the walls.
These different coloured cloths symbolise the seven angels that the Yazidis believe are the greatest servants of God. And if there's a kind of peacock shimmer to them, then perhaps that's not entirely a coincidence, because the greatest of the angels, Yazidis believe, is the peacock angel, Melek Taus, who right at the beginning of time ascended from the heavens and came here to Lalish and shed the radiance of his feathers over the colourless void of things.
But for Yazidis, there's a problem. Stories they tell of Melek Taus echo stories that Muslims tell of the devil.
People are tying knots in the cloths.
And so that is why there has always been this calumny against the Yazidis that they are devil worshippers, that in honouring Melek Taus, the peacock angel, they are in fact Satanists.
Women and children make their way through different rooms.
When ISIS justified their slaughter of Yazidi men and their enslavement of Yazidi women, they did so by quoting a verse from the Quran. And when the sacred months have passed, then kill the mushrikun where you find them, and capture them, and besiege them, and sit in wait for them in every place of ambush.
The women and children have reached a dank, cave-like chamber, where the women bundle cloths into balls and try throwing them to the top of a stone mound.
The mushrikun were the pagans of Mecca, who supposedly worshipped idols of stone. The Yazidis are classed as the pagans of Lalish. Muhammad himself, when he captured Mecca, destroyed its idols, much as Muslim conquerors over the centuries have sought to smash this stone that's been repaired many times.
The thing about ISIS is, it's not just that they think they're justified in doing what they do to the Yazidis. It's much more terrifying than that. They believe that they are following the example of the man who, for Muslims, is the ultimate model to follow. The Prophet Muhammad himself. And it's that conviction that has led them to commit genocide.
Abu Sayyaf, Jordanian jihadi Salafist movement.
The Quran says that the people of the book, by which it specifies Jews and Christians, should be allowed to pay the jizya.
So why is it that Yazidis weren't allowed to pay it?
The same rules do not apply to the mushrikun. They must convert to Islam or be killed.
Were the Islamic State wrong to slaughter Yazidi men and enslave Yazidi women?
The declaration of ISIS caliphate was wrong and hasty. For taking slaves, you need a recognized state and a proper caliph ruling in the name of Islam.
But if someone isn't a Muslim, not a person of the book, one of the mushrikun, and the Quran says that they should be killed, then why isn't it right to kill them?
Any Muslim who turns his back on Islam becomes mushrikun. Either he reverts to Islam or he is killed. No jizya, nothing. Either Islam or death. For those who are born mushrikun, unless there are treaties or agreements, we must kill the mushrikun wherever we find them.
Abu Sayyaf is quoting the Quran. The tragedy is that even today, some Muslims use these words to justify the killing of the Yazidis.
Back in Lalish, the faces of the Yazidi villagers. A woman holding a crying baby, with a worried-looking young girl by her side. A young man in a smart white shirt and black bow tie, and two smiling young girls. A bearded old man, a young girl unable to suppress her smile, then two even younger girls with large brown eyes. A young teenage girl dressed in white, then a middle-aged woman wearing a headscarf adorned with colourful stones. A girl laughing, a mother and her son, then a boy in a black and white striped top, grinning happily. smiling young girl with her hair in bunches. Then, a bearded young man sitting in a doorway. Tom's trekking through the desert.
Muslims have had their dreams of conquest. But so too has the West. Western soldiers crossed this desert. A Western general came here, dreaming of a new Quran.
Tom's minuscule figure dwarfed by a gigantic pyramid.
40 centuries, he told his army, look down upon you.
The sun's setting over the desert.
In 1798, Napoleon's victory in the Battle of the Pyramids won him Egypt. A decisive moment. For the first time, a Muslim country had succumbed to a new and restless civilization. The modern West.
Cairo.
When Napoleon came to Egypt, he saw himself as someone who was bringing light into the darkness of the East.
Tom makes his way through bustling streets.
Napoleon was a man of the Enlightenment, and he despised Islam pretty much as he despised Christianity, as a kind of backward form of superstition. He was completely open about what he was doing. He said, obviously not to the Egyptians, you've got to lull this fanaticism into a false sense of security so that we can destroy it.
The Institut d'Egypte.
What this building brilliantly demonstrates is that when Napoleon came to Egypt, he didn't just bring soldiers with him. He also brought books, he brought scholars of every kind, he brought printing presses and he brought material for chemistry labs and he even brought a balloon. And what this building, the Institut d'Egypte, it's a kind of barrack room for the Enlightenment. Napoleon planted barracks for his soldiers over there, but here he planted an outpost of the Enlightenment. And this was for the good of the Egyptians.
A drawing of the Sphinx backed by the Great Pyramid of Giza.
And this is the result, the Description d'Égypte. At 37 volumes, it was enormous, encyclopedic, a 200-year-old precursor of Wikipedia. But the Institut's original version no longer exists. It was destroyed by fire during the Arab Spring in 2011.
Tom enters a cluttered bookshop.
This bookshop, founded 60 years ago, is now run by a former tenor at the local opera, Hassan Kenny.
I'm very honoured to meet you.
I'm very honoured to meet you, because there's not many traces of Napoleon in Cairo, but you seem to have most
places,
of them.
Only one place.
This is it. He did come yes. with a lot of scientists, a lot of naturalists, yes. a lot of historians.
Because he knew that Egypt had a cultural treasure.
This is from the 1835 edition.
Yes.
So this is the description.
So this is from the...
This is Napoleon and the divan. Yep.
Look. So it is?
Yes.
So it is.
Your friend Napoleon.
Yes. Looking magnificently imperious.
You turn the pages and you can almost feel Napoleon's all-conquering eye.
So this sort of shows the way in which the people who are compiling this, the scientists and the scholars who've come with Napoleon are interested in every aspect.
Yes, everything.
This was not merely scholarship. This was an act of annexation.
God, amazing. In an age before photography, yes. this is as close to looking at a photograph as you'd get. And
yes. No, they didn't miss anything. This is the harem,
public dancers.
When the French come here, they're not just interested in the buildings, they're not just interested in the insects, they're not just interested in the mechanics, they're interested in the Egyptians themselves and what they look like.
Everything you see.
I mean, these aren't individual portraits, these are portraits of types of people.
Mr. Napoleon wants to take everything he has seen and his people have seen to Europe.
What's on show here in Mr. Hassan's bookshop is knowledge, but also a display of power.
A room filled with framed drawings.
The Western eye was restless, searching. There was no aspect of life it did not devour and challenge, and that included Islam itself. Europeans were fixated by the idea of the Orient as something timeless and unchanging. They hadn't come to Egypt simply to colonize Muslim lands. They wanted to colonize Muslim minds as well. The West, like Islam, had universal ambitions. Under its domineering yet seductive influence, the Muslim world began to change. It was under Western pressure that slavery was abolished. So too, the jizya. Napoleon's scholars, sitting on the Sphinx, were sizing up the ancient civilization of the Orient for a future fashioned by the West.
Paris. Tom enters a vast cobbled courtyard, beyond which stands a building with a golden dome.
Napoleon still casts a long shadow. Dead and buried he may be, but his ghost still haunts the Muslim world.
Inside the building is the tomb of Napoleon.
In the wake of his death, Napoleon became the absolute model of a great man. And when Western historians wrote the life of Muhammad, the shadow of Napoleon tended always to be there in the background.
The tomb is sculpted from a block of red stone.
But in the 19th into the 20th century, period dominated by the West, the Western understanding of Muhammad came to influence Muslims. And so you get something really astonishing, because gradually, over the course of time, Muhammad came to be that little bit more Napoleonic.
From a statue of Napoleon to Tom sitting in a cafe, stirring his drink thoughtfully.
Before Napoleon, the Muslim view of Muhammad was a kind of mystical, cosmic one. He was the beloved of God. But in the two centuries since Napoleon, he's become a much more recognisably Western figure, a lawgiver, a state builder. And the process by which Muhammad continues to be shaped by Western values is evident, for instance, in the growing Muslim embarrassment about the story that's told about his favourite wife, Aisha, who, according to tradition, Muhammad married her when she was 6 or 7, consummated the relationship when she was 9, and up until about 30 or 40 years ago, no one had any problem with that. But as anxieties in the West about child abuse have grown, so there's been a gathering movement in the Islamic world to alter the terms of the history to say that Aisha was older. And so the implication of that is astonishing, that actually the West is influencing Muhammad himself. And if the West can influence how Muslims see Muhammad, then the West can influence almost anything. And there are Muslims who are fine with that. But there are plenty of Muslims who are not fine with that.
And one of them, seen here under escort, was an Egyptian, Said Qutb. He was charged with an assassination attempt on Egypt's President Nasser. But Qutb had a message for Muslims everywhere. Before the coming of Muhammad, he said, Arabs had lived in a condition of ignorance. Those were days of superstition, when Pharaoh had ruled, not the prophet, and laws were made by man, not by God. Now, said Qutb, there is a new condition of ignorance. The pervasive influence of the West has corrupted Islam and threatens to destroy God's final revelation to mankind.
The setting sun casting the pyramids into silhouette.
Qutb was executed in 1966. But his message still inspires jihadists around the world. We must return to the pure source, Qutb said, from which the first Muslims derived their guidance, the source that is free from any mixing or pollution.
A jihadist holding the ISIS flag. The Eiffel Tower standing tall over Paris at night.
The 18th of November, 2015. In Saint-Denis, police have hunted down the terrorist who masterminded the Bataclan attacks.
Shaky amateur footage filmed from a window overlooking a back street. Police equipped with powerful torches seem to be firing their weapons at high windows on a block of flats. Another angle shows the flashes of explosions near the top of the building.
In so many ways, what happened here seems almost archetypally, nightmarishly contemporary. What gives what happened here its particular quality of nightmare, what makes it really unsettling, is the location, because if you keep on down this street past where the terrorists were shot to death, and you turn around the corner, what you see is one of the foundational sites, not just of French history, but of Western history as a whole. It's the great origin point of France, of the Gothic, and of the whole culture of medieval Europe. It's the great cathedral of Saint-Denis.
Walking through a square where people are seated at a cafe's tables, Tom heads towards the cathedral. Inside the cathedral's central nave, Tom wanders through the pews. Clerestory windows stand high above the chancel, flooding it with light. Tom cranes his neck to gaze at the scenes depicted in the stained glass windows. From Tom standing by the chancel, soaking up the cathedral's Gothic grandeur, to statues of Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette.
It feels quite dislocating coming here from the site where one of the masterminds of the Bataclan killings was cornered, because these two people as well were the victims of terrorists. This is Louis XVI of France, and this is his Queen Marie Antoinette, both of whom were guillotined in the French Revolution, and their bodies originally were dumped in a common grave, and their remains were then brought here and reburied. And of course, in the French Revolution, as in an ISIS terror video, beheading became a spectacle. And it was a spectacle that was designed to educate morally, to display what happened to wrongdoers and to affirm the values of the people who were doing it.
Stone plaques on a wall.
So these are lists of the kings of France, in fact, going all the way back to before France even existed. And a large number of them were buried here, and they were dug up in 1793 by the revolutionaries. Their bodies were thrown into pits, and lime was poured onto those pits to dissolve everything that remained of them. And the aim of that was to create a kind of year zero. It was to wipe the slate clean. There was a kind of Christian idea about this, because they said that this was the day of judgment on kings. So there was an idea that the apocalypse was being realized, that the New Jerusalem was being founded, and that there was no place in this New Jerusalem for the old order, for the old royal order, and so it just literally had to be erased.
Tom wanders around carved effigies of recumbent monarchs.
There is this strain of yearning for an apocalypse that runs through Islam as well as through Christianity. And so, I mean, it seems odd to say that there could be any kinship between people in the French Revolution and ISIS. But there is a sense in which both of them were inspired by this idea of apocalypse, by an idea that a day of judgment will come when the righteous will be fulfilled and the unrighteous will be condemned. And it sets up a kind of unsettling train of thoughts, because what it brings home is the way in which values that I hold, values that most people in the West hold, the very idea of human rights, were born amid bloodshed. And thinking that in the light of ISIS, you know, having seen what I've seen in Iraq, you think, well, maybe there are parallels there, because ISIS too claim that their acts of terror are in a noble cause, that by washing their victims in blood, they are fertilizing the ground for the establishment of a caliphate that will bring order and happiness to the whole of humanity. And that basically is how the executioners of Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette and many others in the French Revolution justified what they were doing.
From the statues of dead kings, some lying with their hands pressed in prayer, to the drone flying past barren mountains.
What then do we know of our enemy, whose apocalyptic yearnings are so like our own? That they dream, like us, of seeing their values triumph across the world, and they fear that they are losing. Democracy, the tolerance of other religions, universal human rights. That millions of Muslims believe in these is precisely what makes ISIS dread that Islam is being corrupted, makes them determined to scour it clean. And this, in turn, is what makes us determined to fight them.
The drone in flight. Then riot police marching towards a housing estate at night.
Paris, 2005.
Rioters and street fires.
Riots in the banlieue, the suburbs. For France, a state of emergency. If ISIS had their way, this is the shape of things to come.
Police retreating, then an officer approaching people taking refuge inside a building.
France is home to the largest Muslim population in Europe, and the banlieue is where the majority of them live. It's here and in similar neighborhoods all over Europe and America that ISIS feel they have discovered the Achilles heel of the West.
decrepit buildings and a burnt-out car.
ISIS refer to the vast number of Muslims living in the West as the Grey Zone. Despite their setbacks on the battlefield, radicalizing this Grey Zone remains the core of ISIS strategy. Their acts of terror are designed to polarize, to force Muslims in the West to choose between their religion and their country, between Sharia and democracy, between God's law and man's law.
A view over the sprawling banlieue of Paris.
Continents do not separate us anymore. We live side by side. ISIS are fighting a battle for the future of Islam. What happens will determine the future of us all.